test of the emergency alert system. This test was originated by the Multnomah County Emergency Management Agency in cooperation with other emergency management agencies, broadcasters, and cable operators. This system informs you of events that pose an immediate threat to your life, health, or property. If this had been an actual emergency requiring immediate action or evacuation, official message would have followed the alert tone. This test will conclude in 5 seconds.
Everyone else in the room has a role, and those roles are really clear.
Of the emergency alert system, broadcasters, in cooperation with the FCC, have developed this test to keep you informed in the event of an emergency. If this had been an actual emergency, the attention signal you just heard would have been followed by official information, news, or instructions. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffeehouse. Also, thanks to the Oregon Symphony presenting Angelique Kidjo in concert with the Oregon Symphony. More info and tickets for this event with Angelique Kidjo at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall on Tuesday, September 26th, available now at orsymphony.org.
Between the Covers, I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is poet Sophia Sinclair. Born and raised in Montego Bay, Jamaica, Sinclair received her MFA in poetry at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, and is currently a PhD candidate in literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. Her poems have appeared in Poetry Magazine, Granta, The Nation, Boston Review, Kenyon Review, and Oxford American, among many others, and she's a 2016 recipient of the Whiting Writers Award. Her other honors include a Pushcart Prize, a Ruth Lilly and Dorothy Sargent Rosenberg Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation, and fellowships from YADO, the Breadloaf's Writers Conference, and the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown. Sophia Sinclair is here today to talk about her debut collection of poetry, Cannibal, a book that has garnered a remarkable amount of attention and praise. Winner of the Prairie Schooner Book Prize in Poetry, the Addison M. Metcalf Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the OCM Bocas Prize for Caribbean Poetry, and the 2017 Phyllis Wheatley Book Award in Poetry, Cannibal was also named a Notable Book of the Year by the American Library Association, BuzzFeed, Poets and Writers, and The New Yorker. Booklist in its starred review says, "Reading and rereading Sinclair is an urgently necessary, absolutely unparalleled experience." Poet Major Jackson adds that here is a poetry that richly interrogates power and history, while also eloquently and furtively asserting the possibilities of nature, desire, and the body as ceremonial and spiritual sources of resistance and affirmation. Welcome to Between the Covers, Sophia Sinclair.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with the title and the epigraph to the book that describes its origins. This seems to be a crucial key to understanding your project, or at least one crucial key to understanding your project. So what is Cannibal?
Well, you know, I say at the beginning of the book, in the epigraph, I talk about the etymology of the word cannibal and how it's connected to being a Caribbean person. So the word cannibal is the English variant of the Spanish word canibal, which comes from the word caribal, which is a reference to the native Carib people whom Columbus thought ate human flesh and from whom the word Caribbean originates. So the word Caribbean is linked to this idea of being cannibal, being savage, being other, being monstrous.
And you say by virtue of being Caribbean, all West Indian people are already, in a linguistic sense,
Born savage.
So how do you take that and use that as a key towards the explorations you make in the collection as a whole?
Well, I think a lot about this idea of being seen as monstrous and the black body as monstrous and Caribbean people being seen as wild. And thinking about how those ideas reframe how the black body is seen throughout history and how that's connected to how black people are then treated in modern times, but then also thinking about the idea of savagery and is there any power in that, right? Mm-hmm. If I tap into this idea, if I claim this impolite body as mine, where do I go from there?
And as we move into part one of Cannibal, we get two more epigraphs that are on the same page, but in a way feel like they're sitting in a little bit in opposition to each other. One is Shakespeare's The Tempest, spoken by Caliban, and the second is by the Caribbean poet Kamau Brathwaite. I'm hoping we could start with the first one, and
sure.
Maybe if you just read it for us before I ask my question.
So this is actually one of my favorite passages of Caliban's from The Tempest. "Be not afeard, the isle is full of noises, sounds and sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. Sometimes a thousand twangling instruments will hum about mine ears, and sometime voices." And then the Brathwaite quote is, "The hurricane does not roar in pentameters."
So for people who might need a refresher on The Tempest, can you orient us to Caliban?
Sure. So The Tempest is a play about a European duke or something that has been exiled from his country, I think it's Naples, and he is then shipwrecked on an island. And so that's where The Tempest comes from, the storm that shipwrecks him, or The Tempest could be something more inwards. But he's shipwrecked on this island, and he comes across a witch who lives there. Her name is Sycorax. And she teaches him magic, and then he banishes her, and her son is Caliban. And so this Lord Prospero banishes the witch who taught him magic and takes her son Caliban as his slave. And so Prospero and his daughter are living on this island until another shipwreck of passengers come.
And Caliban is when he's described, isn't entirely described as human.
No, he's not. So we have a character who speaks, you know, in lyric, speaks beautifully about his selfhood and what he's lost, but he's described as a monster, fish-headed monster, a fool, and the stage directions just say Prospero's slave or something to that effect.
And Prospero takes it upon himself, from his perspective, as a sort of benevolent civilizing act,
right,
to teach him to speak the Queen's English.
Yes. And there's even a scene where both Prospero and Miranda confront Caliban, and they're like, you know, "We taught you language. Basically, you know, you should be grateful." And, you know, to which Caliban retorts, "You taught me language, and my profit on it is I know how to curse." And I always like that line because it's Caliban sort of saying, well, how can I use your language against you?
Yeah, which is kind of what you were saying.
Yes.
Was the enterprise for you with Cannibal.
Yes.
So you said before, at a very young age, I identified with Caliban as a representative of the linguistic and psychological exile of the Caribbean self, to be forced to speak in the language of the colonist, the language of the oppressor, while also carrying within us the storm of Jamaican patois. We live under a constant hurricane of our doubleness. In many ways, we will always be a stranger to ourselves. As Walcott says, our bodies move in one language and think in another. And this quote resonates with the second epigraph that you've read by Brathwaite. When you say we live under a constant hurricane of our doubleness, he says, in confrontation to Shakespeare, the hurricane does not roar in pentameters.
Yes.
Cannibal enters a long conversation with other Caribbean poets who are engaged with the rewriting of The Tempest. Can you talk about the predecessors that have engaged with the tempest as Caribbean writers and how this enters that conversation.
Sure. So Brathwaite himself does his own decolonization of the tempest, where he had a book called Sycorax, or he invented a language called Sycorax, which is, of course, referencing Caliban's mother, the witch who taught Prospero his magic. And, you know, he goes about using broken syntax and dialect as a way of fathering his own kind of poetic language. Mm. And that is always an important text to me to think about. Even if I go about it differently, I appreciate what Brathwaite is doing with breaking the language to put it back together, constructing it in our own rhythms and meter and music, which is what he means when he talks about the hurricane and rowing in pentameters, which is basically the pentameter itself is a part of English prosody, and it is meant to reflect the natural environment of the British Isles, of England, of the snow falling. But if you're in the Caribbean, that's not the music you hear. That's not the landscape you see, right? It's rich, it's fertile, it's the tropics. Everything is growing into everything else. It's impolite. And so a part of my poetic project is finding some way to reflect that Jamaican and Caribbean landscape on the page in imagery, in music, and metaphor. And then, of course, you also have Césaire, who had his own version of The Tempest called Une Tempête, and he's rewriting the play from the point of view of Caliban himself. And so the final epigraph for the fifth section of the book is referencing Césaire's play, of sort of giving voice back to Caliban and him sort of unnaming himself, stripping the name given to him by Shakespeare and by Prospero and taking the name X.
And that name Caliban is an anagram
for cannibal.
For cannibal also.
Yes.
Could you read us the poem Home?
Home. Have I forgotten it? Wild conch shell dialect, black apostrophe curled tight on my tongue, or how the Spanish built walls of broken glass to keep me out, but the doctor bird kept chasing and raking me in. This place is your place, wreathed in red sargassum, ancient driftwood nursed on the pensive sea, the ramshackle altar I visited often, packed full with fish skull bright with lignum vitae plumes. Father, I have asked so many miracles of it, to be patient and forgiving, to be remade for you in some small wonder. And what a joy to still believe in anything. My diction now as straight as my hair, that stranger we've long stopped searching for. But if somehow our half-sunken hearts could answer, I would cup my mouth in warm bowls over the earth and kiss the wet dirt of home, taste bogue mud and one long orange peel for skin. I'd open my ear for sugar cane and long stalks of gungo peas to climb in. I'd swim the sea still lapsing in its soldered frame, the sea that again and again calls out my name.
We've been listening to Sophia Sinclair read from her collection, Cannibal. And for people who are listening, she didn't look at the poem at all when she was reading, which is really amazing. And it prompts me to ask you this question. The process of writing the poem, how much of it is do you use oration or oration by yourself as figuring out how the poem should sound?
That's a large percentage of how my poems come together. As I'm composing, I'm speaking the words out loud. You know, poetry itself, I think, has to be incantatory in some way. And I always think my neighbors, if I have a neighbor upstairs, I'm like, they must think I'm crazy. But, you know, I read the lines over and over, and I sort of hear where the words have energy, where the music is gathering, and where I need to do some more work.
Mm-hmm. Another entry point into Cannibal seems to be this, the issue of exile, not mm-hmm. just the exile because you're speaking the language of the colonizer, though that for sure, but also an exile from geographic home, but even an exile within your home. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to unpack all of this with you, but I'd like to first start with your first extended experience in the United States.
Yes.
You hadn't spent a lot of time in America before you came to study at Bennington. And you ended up in two schools, Bennington College and the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, that were very hyper white spaces, and your first experiences of America. So let's start with Bennington. You said that you learned that you wanted to be a poet who interrogated the imperial history of the English language and the continued erasure of the Black experience. But I suspect you didn't learn this through a class that was called Black Erasure in the English canon.
If only.
tell us a little bit
that
about.
That would be so great.
Yeah. Tell us how. Tell us what happened for you.
Right.
And how this desire arose from what happened.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that I continue to find myself in very white spaces in the academy, but I didn't know what to expect when I went to Bennington. I got there and I was like, okay, I am one of maybe four students of color in the entire school. And a couple years ago, I was thinking about my coursework, and I realized that in my 4 years at Bennington, I read one Black writer. And it was a short story, a one-page short story by Jamaica Kincaid called Girl. So a large part of my education into Black writers, and particularly Black American writers, was something that I had to do. It's a self-education. But when I got to Bennington, this was something that I had to contend with for the first time, where I felt like, oh, you know, if I spoke my mind, I was then put in this margin of, oh, like you're just upset for no reason, or you're just angry for no reason. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. This is a new hurdle to contend with. And I, you know, where I discovered what I wanted to do as a poet was in a class at Bennington. We were doing a senior thesis project, and I was writing short stories about Jamaica, and I'd use patois, Jamaican dialect. And one of the girls in the class, a white girl, she gave me back my pages from workshop, and she had like all the dialect crossed out and all the like references to Jamaican culture, flora, like whatever was strange to her. She had like had question marks or crossed them out and said, can you say it in English, or can you redefine this, etc. And it sent me over the edge, right? So it's just like, no, I sat down and I wrote a manifesto. Like, that's what I called it, a literary manifesto. And I came back the next week. I quoted Caliban. I said, you know, my language is not going to be colonized or cauterized. And from this point forward, like, I'm going to define what I want to speak about and what I find are the important experiences.
Hmm. And you've said that was poorly received.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell us what that means? Like, how did that affect your experience post-manifesto at the school that you'd sort of thrown down the gauntlet in class with your peers and your teacher.
But you see, I always just think, well, I'm just telling the truth. I didn't expect everyone to get upset. But, you know, I said something to the effect of, you know, I'm going to be honest, I'm not writing for you, right? And can you imagine that somebody could be writing something that's not for you, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I said...
it seems simple on the one hand, but extremely probably shocking to the audience to this manifesto at the same time.
I know. And I, you know, I said something like, what can a table of corn-fed strangers tell me about my work, speaking about the Caribbean? Which, you know, that was, you know, prodding a little bit, but, you know, everyone was just so upset. One person threw the pages across the room, across the table to me. I was just like, wow, I didn't expect these white liberals to get quite so upset. But I don't know if they went home and interrogated why they were so upset. I was the one who went home, and I was still upset about someone telling me that what I'd written needed to be translated for an American audience or a white audience or this Western hegemony of this is our culture and everyone in the world is supposed to know our references. But if you do it, it's exotic.
And what's interesting about that, too, is that even in that scenario, when you read The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot, you're having to look up all those references.
Footnotes, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's not like even in the canon, the expectation to look outside for the references is accepted if it is a white European or American writer,
right.
I think. This might be a good time to read The Art of Unselfing.
The Art of Unselfing. The mind's black kettle hisses its wild exigencies at every turn, the hour before the coffee and the hour after. Pen scratch of the gone morning, woman a pitched hysteria watching the mad ant scramble, her small wants devouring, her binge and skin thrall, her old selves being shuffled off into labyrinths, this birdless sky a longing. Her moth mouth rabble on facing these touch and go months under winter, torn letters under floorboards, each fickle moon pecked through with doubt. And one spoiled onion, pale cyclops on her kitchen counter, now sprouting green missives, some act of contrition, neighbor God's vacuum, a loud rule thrown down. Her mother now on the line saying too much. This island is not a martyr. You tinker too much with each gaunt memory, your youth and its unweeding. Not everything blooms here a private history. Consider this immutable. Consider our galloping sun, its life, your starved homesickness. The paper wasp kingdom you set fire to, watched for days until it burnt a city in you, until a family your hands could not save became the hurricane. How love is still unrooting you. And how to grow a new body, to let each word be the wild rain swallowed pure like an antidote. Her mother at the airport saying, don't come back. Love your landlocked city. Money, buy a coat. And even exile can be glamorous. Some nights she calls across the deaf ocean to no one in particular. No answer. Her heart's double vault, a muted hydra. This hour, a purge of its own unselfing. She must make a home of it.
You've been listening to Sophia Sinclair read from her debut collection of poetry, Cannibal. You were once asked about your notion of audience as you write poems, and you said that sometimes you find yourself writing to God, but that you see God as a pathetic, patriarchal figure that's disheveled and tattered. And it is this figure that
I said that?
Oh, yeah.
That sounds right.
Well, at least that you write to a God.
Yes.
That you imagine this way, not that God is this way necessarily, but that you said sometimes you imagine a God like this.
Yeah.
Can you talk a
don't
little bit?
Don't you? David?
I don't know that I've ever imagined a God as I was writing a poem.
Yeah.
But I might try it.
Yeah. I don't know why. It's just another sort of act of imagination, but it is, I talk about this a lot, that the page is a place where I felt the first sense of belonging. And that's because I felt so muted and so silenced in so many different ways that this was the only place where I felt where I could speak back. Mm. And I think I'm still just speaking back.
Yeah.
To all these different patriarchal systems, which seems to me always rooted somehow in this idea of God. And so I'm speaking back to that idea.
Could you read for us Pocomania and
sure.
How to Be an Interesting Woman?
Okay. I like these pigs. These are, you surprising me.
Are they unusual pigs? As far as what you end up reading?
No, some of them I read regularly when I give readings, and some I haven't read at all. So okay. I like that.
Yeah.
Keeping me on my toes.
Good.
Okay. Pocomania. Father unbending, father unbroken, father with the low-hanging belly. Father I was cleaved from, pressed into, cast and remolded. Father I was forged in the fire of yourself. Ripped my veined skin, one eyelid, father, my black tangle of hair and teeth. Born yellowed and wrinkled, father, your jackfruit, foster my overripe flesh. Father, your first daughter, now severed at the ankles, father, your black machete. I remember your slick smell, your seed dark, your rum froth, wailed and smeared my wet jelly across your cheek. Father, forgive my impossible demands. I conjure you in woven tam, line of Judah, father, your red, gold, and green. Father, a flag I am waving. Father, a flag I am burning. Father, skittering in on a boat of whale skeleton, his body wrapped in white like an Orthodox priest. Father and his nest of acolyte women, his beard comber, his primrose, his dahlia, his Nagasaki blossom. Mother and I were none of them. Father washing me in eucalyptus, in garlic, in golden seal. Fathering my exorcism, father the harsh brine of my sea. Making sounds only the heart can feel. Father a burrowing insect, his small incision. No bleat, but a warm gurgle. Daughter entering this world a host. Father your beach animal, your lamentations in the sand. Mother her red bones come knocking. Mother, her red bones come knocking at the floorboards. My mother knock knocking at his skull when he dreams. Scratching at your door, my dry rattle of Morse code. Father, let me in. With the mash mouth spirits who enter us, father, the split fibula where the marrow must rust. Father, the soft drum in my ear. Daughter on weeding her familiar mischief. Mother jangling the rib cage. I am here.
Thanks so much for being on the show today, Sophia.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking today to Sophia Sinclair, the author of the poetry collection Cannibal. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Folk Music Society's monthly concerts beginning Friday, September 15th, at Colonial Heights Presbyterian Church in Portland. The Portland Folk Music Society's monthly concerts will be featuring live folk music every third Friday of the month, beginning September 15th through May. Again, that's Portland Folk Music Society's monthly concerts every third Friday of the month, beginning Friday, September 15th, at Colonial Heights Presbyterian Church, 2828 Southeast Stevens in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Have you received your KBOO Silent Drive letter in the mail? Here's your chance to support your favorite community radio station and enter a chance to win some fabulous prizes. No letter? No worries. Go to KBOO.fm to find out more about what you could win when you donate to KBOO between now and September 14th. Here's a teaser. The grand prize is a 3-day, 2-night stay at El Dorado Resort and Casino with airfare in the biggest little city in the world. Yes, that's Reno, Nevada. The first prize is a night out on Burnside with a night at the Jupiter Hotel, with dinner at Le Pigeon, drinks at Cider Riot, and breakfast at Grendel, so you can dive deep into the Burnside nightlife. And our second prize will allow you to stock up on medicinal and recreational treats at Jane PDX. Go to kboo.fm to donate. When we come together, we build our community's resilience, and there's no better time to invest in KBOO than now.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Jazz Presents Tia Fuller Quartet, September 15th at the Fremont Theater in Portland. Tia Fuller is an award-winning band leader. Her uncanny ability to spellbind audiences has also led her to many prestigious gigs, including a highly coveted position as lead saxophonist and featuring soloist for pop star Beyoncé's all-female touring band. Again, that's PDX Jazz Presents Tia Fuller Quartet, September 15th at 9:30 p.m. at the Fremont Theater, 2393 Northeast Fremont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.